C.S. Lewis, First and Last, God in the Dark. I'm Norman Nagel. I'd suggest that we might begin with testimonials. How C.S. Lewis changed my life. Or what it was that he said that was most illuminating, or most helpful, or most troubling. And what you would suggest as the best place to start with C.S. Lewis. And when we've had a round of testimonials, I'll read a piece out of God in the Dark, see what's going on there and how it works, and then raise the question, is that the sort of putting of Jesus Christ that we particularly need in our day? And what are its strengths and its inadequacies? So you are here as those who are interested in C.S. Lewis. Perhaps you are also here as those who are in some way indebted to him. Could we just have a quick round of what it was, where you began with C.S. Lewis, or what it was, the point at which you said, ah, this is really shedding light on things and making them clearer and helpful.
Well, I was baptized as a college junior. I met C.S. Lewis as a college senior when a Missouri Synod professor included Screwtape Letters in a course on great English classics. I remember writing a paper on C.S. Lewis for that class that ended with a comment, "Of course, this will never be one of the great English classics." That was the only thing that the in my paper that the professor took exception to. I just couldn't believe anything could be great because it was that easy to read.
I have read many of his works. I love the Space Trilogy, and I read it as sort of, pagan period in my life, and realized it had no Christian significance whatsoever at that point because all I was reading was the Space Trilogy. I read it again about 2 years ago, and it's probably one of the most profound works of fiction that I've ever read. I mean, from a Christian standpoint. And so I saw two completely different sets of literature.
I came here to find out what C.S. Lewis is all about.
I pass.
John.
A few years back, a pastor of mine, who was a great C.S. Lewis fan, was leading some studies on some of the books. And that was my first real large introduction into what was there. We read a few of the Space Trilogy books there, and Mere Christianity, Screwtape Letters. I enjoyed them all in very different ways, as they're very different literature. And I found very much profound there, and very much that was applicable to Christianity in our time. So I really enjoyed it. I'm planning on reading more.
For me, a philosophy professor at college in the 40s, after a conversation we had had about I know not what, said, "I think you would enjoy C.S. Lewis' Problem of Pain." So that was where I started, and I got really hooked in fast, and then read Great Divorce, Mere Christianity, and I don't know, I guess about six or eight others, and had done very little reading of C.S. Lewis since. At this point, it's kind of a blur. I just remember that I was very, very excited about it when I was reading it, and it's probably sort of gotten into being a part of me somehow.
Or have you grown out of it?
I don't know. I really don't know, because at this point it's a blur what actually was there.
And I've read some of C.S. Lewis's books, and one of the most interesting things I found is in my study of Mormonism, that the Mormons are absolutely enthralled with C.S. Lewis. And they try reading all these books, including Mere Christianity, and they get the gospel spoken to them consistently from C.S. Lewis, and yet they still love him.
I know he's a writer, but I don't do a heck of a lot of reading, so I've never read any C.S.
Do you have any comments?
Well, I heard people earlier in the week talk about C.S. Lewis, and earlier in my life talk about him, but I picked up a couple of books out of the library and understanding more about him, or trying to begin to understand about him.
I'm here to check up on our senior pastor church is all screaming.
We'd better not find C.S. Lewis too inadequate then.
I'm here to find out about what my daughter's reading. My 12-year-old has read the Space Trilogy, and I want to know what that's all about.
Has she read the Narnias?
Yeah. She's really hooked on them. I could never get into them. I've read some of the other stuff that's written in college. I've forgotten it all.
I've read some things in college too, but I really can't get into them, so I'm here to get into them.
Read Mere Christianity, the Screwtape Letters, and the book A Severe Mercy, Sheldon Van Auken. C.S. Lewis has quite a few letters that he wrote to this couple, especially as they were going through the period where the wife was dying.
Grief observed. That speaks very profoundly to many people.
I just came to learn.
As a teenager, I read Screwtape Letters and wasn't sure just what to think. I decided that anyone that could write the Chronicles of Narnia had to be okay. And I also have read the letters in the Severe Mercy and really enjoyed that.
I can't remember exactly when I started or what I started with, but I've read just about everything except God in the Dock, so that's why I'm here.
That's the last in the title.
I've read a few of his books, and I'm indebted to him for an occasion about a month ago. I was supposed to give a talk the last Sunday that I spent in my church, and the text that Sunday was John 7:37-39, anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. And I wanted an illustration. And I just, you know, flipping through books, looking for something. And I opened up the C.S. Lewis book that I hadn't read yet. And there was the perfect illustration about a little girl who was thirsty, and Aslan was sitting by the stream, and the only way that she could get a drink was to go to Aslan, risk being eaten.
Well, I've heard a lot about C.S. Lewis, but I've never read anything by him. And I guess I came to find out why people found him so fascinating.
I haven't read anything on C.S.
In high school, I read Out of the Silent Planet, and when I was into science fiction and found it not very good science fiction. Subsequently, I suppose sometime after college, during college, I read the Screwtape Letters, and I think that precipitated my return to Christianity. And then since then, I've read the Narnia stories to my kids, and I've read The Grief Observed, as you mentioned, and a couple of them.
Well, the Screwtape Letters were probably the first religious book I ever read when I was like 12 or 13, and so it sort of stayed with me, you know, he must be someone interesting. Mm-hmm.
Screwtape Letters was the first one I read of his, and then that was when I was in my teens. And then I was reintroduced to him with Mere Christianity and The Great Divorce, and I think his Narnia tales are of the greatest.
I never read any of your books.
I began my ministry 40 years ago, and Screwtape Letters was the first introduction. And after that, I found a great deal of homiletical material and pastoral help in books that dealt with grief and miracles, and there was a lot of pastoral assistance given there. I suppose one that really fascinated me was Surprised by Joy, his own autobiography.
Well, I spent a year here on a program called Lifestyle, and 50%, not more, of what we read was C.S. Lewis. But the one that nobody has mentioned yet is The Four Loves, and I think that is my favorite and speaks closest to me, and I just happened to listen to a tape on it this morning from my year. He did the whole book in a series of radio talks
from very sketchy notes, and it took us 5 hours to discuss the book, let alone to go through it. So it was very fascinating and rich.
I love to read, but I came here to find out why he's so popular. We touched on it in the church at Trinity Premier Christianity.
My kids are the philosophers in my house, and I'm just trying to keep up with them.
I've never read anything of his either, but our campus pastor quotes him all the time, so I thought he must be good.
My college roommate sparked an interest, and I just want to find out what he want. What he's always telling me about.
I have not read any of them.
I also have lots of friends that have said, get into it and read them.
That happened to me.
Oh, no, okay.
I've read enough not to be able to be authority to know that there's someone there who deserves respect and deserves
respect. I read a couple of his books a few years ago, and then just recently, Severe Mercy. And that was when I became, when I was really introduced to C.S. Lewis as a person, and became really interested in reading and finding out more about him.
I fell in love with C.S. Lewis through a class in seminary entitled Theology of C.S. Lewis Taught by Walt Bowman.
What was so great about it?
I had never read anything of his until that point. And there we did an awful lot of reading. And I think for me, as much as I liked a number of his different works and continue to reread and now have gotten some of the tapes of the Narnia Tales, his autobiography still holds out in my mind as being the best. I think just because of the experience he had coming to faith.
That he was unbeliever.
Right.
And came.
Students at school, and they wanted more, and I became a little bit cautious because some of them were coming and saying, "You've got that in your church library," and I didn't know how, you know, how I could, if I could help them draw from the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the underlying message or not. But I felt really glad that I could introduce this.
I have not read C.S. Lewis yet, but and I came to find out I've already mentioned a lot up here. But I was wondering, I've heard a lot of titles. What would you recommend as a first book by C.S. Lewis for someone to read?
Well, that's what's going to emerge out of these testimonials. Nobody's mentioned God in the dock yet.
I too have not read any C.S. Lewis, and I hope yourself, all of us that haven't, you know, do him justice. Otherwise, we may not read him.
I've never read him, but when I was a child, my mother read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe to me. And it's real dim coming back as you're reading it to us in Narnia. Yeah.
I was introduced to C.S. Lewis through A Severe Mercy, and I read a couple of the Narnia Tales and Mere Christianity.
I know nothing of C.S. Lewis.
Read a few things, but not all of these, not these works, probably.
I believe it was Prelandia, he says, thinking of the way Christianity runs the theme through his works, Thingamagubbie's soap is soap from the first bubble to the very last.
Well, I kind of stumbled over C.S. Lewis. I lived out in a farm community that didn't have a library, and I subscribed to the Time Life series, the pocketbooks, and received Screwtape's letters. Aha! And truly enjoyed that, and that was about 18 years ago. And then just every once in a while, we'll read one of his books and really enjoy it. Mere Christianity and Out of the Silence. I like those too. My son gave me those for Christmas New Year's.
I'm here to learn more about that one because I hadn't heard of that one. God in the Dock, is it?
I took an interim course in college that we studied all of C.S. Lewis's books, and I started out with Surprised by Joy.
Most of my friends and family have read most of his books, but I've only read Great Divorce and Severe Mercy. But I'm kind of familiar with most of them by secondhand now.
I remember reading Screwtape Letters when I was in high school and really thinking it was great, and I remember my home pastor not thinking it was so great. Really discouraging me from reading it. And I'm glad I stuck with it. I've had a problem of pain on my desk to read for about 6 months, and I haven't got it yet.
Well, Screwtape Letters came to me as a newly awakened Christian, I suppose, when I was about 14. And I enjoyed it, but I really came because I'm in love with your voice.
There are some good things in C.S. Lewis which would make you ashamed of saying. Oh. It's the matter.
I think when I really became aware of C.S. Lewis, I'm sure I had probably heard about him most of my college years and so forth, but was a lady up here that said, if your children have not read the Narnia series, they have got to read them. And after they had read them, the one son who was a reader anyway, I picked up the dog-eared copy and I read the first one and I wept. I thought it was so moving. And then I went back and asked him, do you know what this means? I thought, you know, does he really know what this is about? And he did. But now I want to know how God can get in a dock.
I haven't read anything about it, I'm just kidding.
I haven't either, but I am going to wait for your advice to see where I should start.
The same. I just heard a lot about him from different pastors and professors that I'd like to know more about.
Any other comment?
We didn't hear from you.
Oh, I just got here.
What does C.S. Lewis mean to you?
I've read the Chronicles of Narnia and its philosophical argument for Christianity and thought they were good. I wanted to know more.
If anyone wants to get married at Valpo, I tell them they daresn't do it unless they've read the chapter on Eros in The Four Loves, the love between a man and a woman. And I go on to say, if you are thinking of rearing any children, you'd better be knowing the Narnia story. So, Four Loves, Narnia stories, mere Christianity.
Letters to Malcolm.
Letters to Malcolm, yeah.
That's my favorite.
Yeah,
particularly about prayer. That is one of his most charming works. And he's able to put matters so unpretentiously. He's an astonishingly learned man, but he's got it so well under control. he loves and uses language with a simplicity and a clarity and a wit and a charm that are so very engaging. So that children read with enjoyment, and you can come back to it 20 years later and say, wow, it is possible for him to put the weightiest matters with astonishing simplicity. And help you then to face questions and to think them through. The one work which nobody's mentioned where his learning does sort of stick out a bit is the Pilgrim's Regress, which is his first work. He wasn't quite so master of his learning or his style when he first started, I suppose. And then there's his own works in his scholarly field,
He made his scholarly reputation on the tradition of courtly love in literature called the Allegory of Love, and he wrote the volume in the Oxford History of English Literature on the 16th century. He also wrote a very helpful book about Milton, which clears the air a great deal. So that there are the works of imagination, the children's stories, which presuppose so many things or feed a whole lot of things into the way of thinking about the world and life, but with the specific particularity of vivid people. The space trilogy, they're a pleasure for those who are particularly like that. The piece and God in the Dark is sort of what the editor found lying around after C.S. Lewis had departed. These are not major works. It's a collection of all sorts of things. There are some treasures here, some real gems, and other things that are quite ephemeral, ephemeral responses to the day, and so on. Evil and God, miracles, dogma and the universe, answers to questions on Christianity, myth became fact, horrid red things, religion and science, the laws of nature, the grand miracle, Christian apologetics, work and prayer, man or rabbit, on the transmission of Christianity, miserable offenders, the founding of the Oxford Socratic Club, religion without dogma, some thoughts, the trouble with X, what are we to make of Jesus Christ? And that is a short piece that represents his whole apologetic approach, the putting, the defending, the extolling of the Christian faith, the Christian message. I'll read this through quickly and then we'll recognize a good number of things that perhaps you bumped into along the way, and then we'll ask the questions of, is this the sort of putting of the Christian faith that we most need today? What are we to make of Jesus Christ? This is a question which has, in a sense, a frantically comic side. For the real question is not, what are we to make of Christ, but what is he to make of us? The picture of a fly sitting, deciding what it is going to make of an elephant, has comic elements about it. But perhaps the questioner meant, what are we to make of him in the sense of, how are we to solve the historical problem set us by the recorded sayings and acts of this man? This problem is to reconcile two things. On the one hand, you have got the almost generally admitted depth and sanity of his moral teaching, which is not very seriously questioned, even by those who are opposed to Christianity. In fact, I find when I am arguing with very anti-God people that they rather make a point of saying, I am entirely in favor of the moral teaching of Christianity. And there seems to be a general agreement that in the teaching of this man and of his immediate followers, moral truth is exhibited at its purest and best. It is not sloppy idealism, it is full of wisdom and shrewdness. The whole thing is realistic, fresh to the highest degree, the product of a sane mind. That is one phenomenon. The other phenomenon is the quite appalling nature of this man's theological remarks. You all know what I mean, and I want rather to stress the point that the appalling claim which this man seems to be making is not merely made at one point in his career. There is, of course, the one moment which led to his execution, the moment at which the high priest said to him, "Who are you?" "I am the anointed, the son of the uncreated God, and you shall see me appearing at the end of all history as the judge of the universe." But that claim, in fact, does not rest on this one dramatic moment. When you look into his conversation, you will find this sort of claim running through the whole thing. For instance, he went about saying to people, I forgive your sins. Now, it is quite natural for a man to forgive you, to forgive something you do to him. Thus, if somebody cheats me out of £5, it is quite possible and reasonable for me to say, well, I forgive him, we will say no more about it. What on earth would you say if somebody had done you out of £5 and I said, that's all right, I forgive him? Then there is a curious thing which seems to slip out almost by accident. On one occasion, this man is sitting looking on Jerusalem from the hill above it, and suddenly in comes an extraordinary remark, I keep on sending you prophets and wise men. Nobody comments on it. And yet, quite suddenly, almost incidentally, he is claiming to be the power that through all the centuries is sending wise men and leaders into the world. Here is another curious remark. In almost every religion, there are unpleasant observances, like fasting. This man suddenly remarks one day, no one need fast while I'm here. Who is this man who remarks that his mere presence suspends all normal rules? Who is the person who can suddenly tell the school they can have a half holiday? Sometimes the statements put forward the assumption that he, the speaker, is completely without sin or fault. This is always the attitude. You to whom I am talking are all sinners, and he never remotely suggests that this same reproach can be brought against him. He says, I am begotten of the one God, before Abraham was, I am. And remember what the words I am were in Hebrew. They were the name of God, which must not be spoken by any human being, the name which it was death to utter. Well, that is the other side. On the one side, clear, definite moral teaching. On the other, claims which, if not true, are those of a megalomaniac, compared with whom Hitler was the most sane and humble of men. There is no halfway house, and there is no parallel in other religions. If you had gone to Buddha and asked him, are you the son of Brahma? He would have said, my son, you are still in the veil of illusion. If you had gone to Socrates and asked, are you Zeus? He would have laughed at you. If you had gone to Mohammed and asked, are you Allah? He would first have rent his clothes and then cut your head off. If you had asked Confucius, are you heaven? I think he would have probably replied, remarks which are not in accordance with nature are in bad taste. The idea of a great moral teacher saying what Christ said is out of the question. In my opinion, the only person who can say that sort of thing is either God or a complete lunatic suffering from that form of delusion which undermines the whole mind of man. If you think you are a poached egg when you are looking for a piece of toast to suit you, you may be sane, but if you think you are God, there's no chance for you. We may note in passing that he was never regarded as a mere moral teacher. He did not produce that effect on any of the people who actually met him. He produced mainly three effects: hatred, terror, adoration. There was no trace of people expressing mild approval. What are we to do about reconciling the two contradictory phenomena? One attempt consists in saying that the man did not really say these things, but that his followers exaggerated the story, and so the legend grew up that he had said them. This is difficult because his followers were all Jews. That is, they belonged to that nation which of all others was most convinced that there was only one God, that there could not possibly be another. It is very odd that this horrible invention about a religious leader should grow up among the one people in the whole world least likely to make such a mistake. On the contrary, we get the impression that none of his immediate followers, or even of the New Testament writers, embraced the doctrine at all easily. Another point is that on that view, you would have to regard the accounts of the man as being legends. Now, as a literary historian, I am perfectly convinced that whatever else the Gospels are, they are not legends. I have read a great deal of legends, and I am quite clear that they are not the same sort of thing. They are not artistic enough to be legends. From an imaginative point of view, they are clumsy. They don't work up to things properly. Most of the life of Jesus is totally unknown to us, as is the life of anyone else who lived at that time. And no people building up a legend would allow that to be so. Apart from bits of the Platonic dialogues, there are no conversations that I know of in ancient literature, like the fourth gospel. There is nothing even in modern literature until about 100 years ago, when the realistic novel came into existence. In the story of the woman taken in adultery, we are told Christ bent down and scribbled in the dust with his finger. Nothing comes of this. No one has ever based any doctrine on it. And the art of inventing little irrelevant details to make an imaginary scene more convincing is a purely modern art. Surely, the only explanation of this passage is that the thing really happened. The author put it in simply because he'd seen it. Then we come to the strangest story of all, the story of the resurrection. It is very necessary to get the story clear. I heard a man say, "The importance of the resurrection is that it gives evidence of survival, evidence that the human personality survives death." On that view, what happened to Christ would be what had always happened to all men, the difference being that in Christ's case, we were privileged to see it happen. This is certainly not what the earliest Christian writers thought. Something perfectly new in the history of the universe had happened. Christ had defeated death. The door which had always been locked had for the very first time been forced open. This is something quite distinct from mere ghost survival. I don't mean that they disbelieved in ghost survival. On the contrary, they believed in it so firmly that on more than one occasion, Christ had to assure them that he was not a ghost. The point is that while believing in survival, they yet regarded the resurrection as something totally different and new. The resurrection narratives are not a picture of survival after death. They record how a totally new mode of being has arisen in the universe. Something new had appeared in the universe, as new as the first coming of organic life. This man, after death, does not get divided into ghost and corpse. A new mode of being has arisen. That is the story. What are we going to make of it? The question is, I suppose, whether any hypothesis covers the fact so well as the Christian hypothesis. That hypothesis is that God has come down into the created universe, down to manhood, and come up again, pulling it up with him. The alternative hypothesis is not legend, nor exaggeration, nor the apparition of a ghost. It is either lunacy or lies. Unless one take the second alternative, and I can't, one turns to the Christian theory. What are we to make of Christ? There is no question of what we can make of him. It is entirely a question of what he intends to make of us. You must accept or reject the story. The things he says are very different from what any other teacher has said. Others say, "This is the truth about the universe. This is the way you ought to go." But he says, "I am the truth and the way and the life." He says, "No man can reach absolute reality except through me. Try to retain your own life and you will be inevitably ruined. Give yourself away and you will be saved." He says, "If you are ashamed of me, if when you hear this call you turn the other way, I will also look the other way when I come again as God without disguise. If anything whatever is keeping you from God and from me, whatever it is, throw it away. If it is your eye, pull it out. If it is your hand, cut it off. If you put yourself first, you will be last. Come to me, everyone who is carrying a heavy load. I will set that right. Your sins, all of them, are wiped out. I can do that. I am rebirth. I am life. Eat me, drink me, I am your food. And finally, do not be afraid. I have overcome the whole universe. That is the issue. Why do we believe? Some people say, I believe because it is absurd. Some people say, I believe because it makes sense. Or, I believe because unbelief makes nonsense. Or, I believe because it makes me feel good. Or, I believe in order to understand. Does C.S. Lewis fit under any of those alternatives?
Unbelief makes nonsense.
I think all of them.
In the piece that we have just read, the attempt he has made is to show that it's really nonsense to say anything else about Jesus than to confess him as your Lord and your Savior. Unbelief makes nonsense.
But to do that, he has to bridge the logical gap and say that he refuses to believe that it's lies or that it's lunacy. He never defeats those two hypotheses. He merely states that he doesn't want to believe them.
That would leave with you the case for showing Jesus to be a lunatic or a liar. And he suggests that the evidence simply doesn't support any such suggestion. Even those who oppose Jesus do not assert that he's a lunatic or a liar. They say he is a great moral teacher and a beautiful man.
But it would be a good task for him to try to do that. For that individual who said that, yes. Because in the fact of him trying to make him to be an insane man, he would come to the reality of Christ and who he said.
One of the great things that Lewis is always urging is to think things through to the end.
It was in effect his own path.
Right. And he also laments people who have sort of half a dozen self-contradictory notions being held at the same time. And that we only come clear of such muddle-headedness if we think each one of them through all the way, see where it brings us.
I think what makes him most profound to me is he takes all the basic assumptions and analyzes them one by one. And if anyone has, all of us have basic assumptions, but very few of us look at them. We just seem to accept the fact that they exist and then go upon building a building on them, even though what we may be building on is hay, wood, and stubble. Not worth building anything on.
I think that's one of the really powerful things about pure Christianity. If someone sits down with that book and honestly and objectively reads it, other than scripture, which takes, I believe, more interpretation for someone unfamiliar with Christianity, sit down and read that from start to end and really analyze their own thoughts, their own preconceptions, their own beliefs in the light of that book, I find it difficult to believe that anyone could reject the validity of Christ and what he's taught. They possibly could still reject Christ because of what they see as the cost, or but it's, I just, and this was almost to me a capsule view of the book. I mean, he's crammed all of it into that one short essay.
He is devastating of muddle-headedness and of objections to Christ. He shows them to be the product of failing to face up to the issues and the questions and to think them all through. Part answers to little questions just won't survive. The sort of illuminating discussion that he gives them. And he, as a true scholar, takes those positions and pushes them as far as they are able to take you. And then you are at the point of recognizing what still remains of distance to go in facing the number one issues and questions.
I think he does that probably best in an area that's really difficult in here, which is certain type of, I think it's a book for Christians because it is pretty involved, but to take, I had problems with not necessarily virgin birth, but some of the miracles, or the existence of modern miracles. And yet I think that was probably the most illuminating thing I've ever read. But there he took the same thing. And all the possible arguments for and against, and logically went through them, and left you in a position where you either, you know, have to call Lewis a lunatic, or, and he leads you through, so that you have to make those decisions yourself, but it's really difficult to argue with his conclusions. Partly because I'm sure that he was very learned and very adept at the science of argument or the science of deductive reasoning. Or is I'm too far away from philosophy now, is deductive or inductive, but build a point and follow through logically, step by step.
Which is to think clearly. Just this morning in Narnia, the professor, or was it yesterday morning, said, what are they teaching the children in school nowadays? Don't they teach them any logic anymore? That is to think clean, clear, and straight. And that is, he exemplifies that so beautifully.
But did he come to faith through that kind of clear, logical thinking? Surprised by joy indicates that he was brought into the kingdom kicking and screaming. Now, I have a little hard time here. I see all this beautiful system that evolved out of that experience, but what brought him to that experience? He almost makes it a mystical, if that, I remember correctly.
That brings us to the next point of if he does that with his books, how is it that everybody, having read the books, does not shout, hurrah, Jesus is the Lord?
Well, I haven't read a lot of his books real extensively, but I should think that, I've always thought that faith comes, you can't logically reason out that there is a God, and at least in my own faith experience, through my thinking patterns, I can get just as easily on the track. I mean, yeah, I think when I finally come down to the very bottom and just question and question to the very furthest, it's, I come to a wall where I have to say, now I just believe because of faith. And it seems like he almost leaves that out in a way, because he kind of closes all these doors and says, well, see, now I've proved it. And I don't think you can ever do that, because that's leaving out faith.
And do you make it true because you believe it?
But that's foolish, I guess. But that's, I can't ever get to that point where I say, well, now I've proved it. I've never been able to do that.
Faith is the substance of things, hopefully evidence of things not seen. He presents a magnificent presentation of the evidence of who Christ is. But each man must decide, okay, now who is he? He said he's God, so now at this point, what am I to do? Well, if he's God and he exists, then I should say, well, I should speak to him. He won't desire to speak to me, that's why he's all written down. He's reaching out to me. Now I think at the point where I say, yes, Lord, yes, Jesus, start. There is a God, and he wants to speak to me. I think it's at that point that we are all touched.
Do we come to faith because somebody has proved it to us? To prove it to us is to make it an inescapable conclusion.
Man can escape anything that he chooses to. I mean, psychologically, maybe not physically, but. And I think this is what happens when someone does say, read mere Christianity, and comes away and says, yes, that's a really good, strong argument, and it makes a lot of sense, and I can't argue with it, but at this point in my life, I'm not ready. Or maybe the year after next, it will make more sense for my life. You know, maybe that's true, but I don't need a God right now. It's really easy to evade truth, reality. In small ways, each one of us probably does it every day.
Logical arguments for the truth or untruth, well, for the divinity of Christ, never really have sunk in to me. Even this one doesn't really sink in. It's more the gut level reaction I had when I had an experience where I came to know God. Now I had no control over it, had nothing to do with logical arguments. And people for centuries been trying to prove God logically, and it may be a worthy cause, but I don't think so many people have been convinced and become believers because of logical arguments.
I think you come to faith when you prove to yourself. You know, and it may be through this logical argument, or it may be an experience or anything else, but I don't see how anyone, Lewis or anyone else, can prove faith for someone else.
I don't think that Lewis believed that you could bring a person to faith through logical argument, but I think that he experienced that you come to a place after you've been thinking about these things logically, that to go back to unbelief takes a larger leap of faith. And so the only thing to do is to make a choice, leap forward into faith or backwards into unbelief, but you have to make that leap of faith. And
something that I think it is God who is reaching down to us. Still the point is that it's his spirit working in us the faith. It is he that is making us, helping us to believe.
Old Forklin man at the Hanford Common Courts, and his answer to all of it was, you got to believe. He said, anybody start talking about the Lord or Christ, says you don't know, he says, all you believe, you got to believe. That's the only thing you can get out of it.
If somebody's just telling me to believe, then I'll say, okay, I'll try real hard to believe. Sometimes it won't work. That is to leave the whole matter in man, the anthropocentric position. A good deal of, well, and that's where the answer falls when Christ is rejected. Christ is rejected, the reasons you look for in man. Logic works by compelling necessity. You try and hang that on Jesus, and nobody is one of his by his exercise of compulsion. Nobody is one of Christ's because Christ sort of hit us over the head or put a gun in our ribs and said, come along, chum. He does not work by any compulsion. What was dead, he makes alive when he comes through to us with all that he is and all that he's done for us. And we know ourselves to be at the receiving end of that. And that is faith. Faith isn't something that we do. Faith is our being given to, our knowing ourselves to be given Christ and all that he has done for us. And it is his saying to us, you're one of mine. You are forgiven and you are linked in with the life that the whole show is about, that I share with you. And that may not be sort of put back into the anthropocentric thing as I decided for Jesus, or Jesus is my savior because I believe that he is. So long as the I is the operative one doing the verbs, you are in the wobbly ground of anthropocentricity. That's where the problem is. The great achievement of C.S. Lewis knocks away a whole lot of the crutches of unbelief. And you are sort of left naked. He won't let you talk that sort of nonsense. His apologetics have an enormous sort of negative achievement, and then his statement of Christ is proclaiming the gospel, and it's the Jesus that comes through there that is the answer that we would give to this question. I believe because of Jesus. Dorothy Sayers has a wonderful part in her book, Dramatization of the Life of Christ, The Man Born to be King, The Call of Matthew. Matthew just sort of, Jesus says, come on, Matthew, and he gets up and follows Jesus, and people laugh and mock him, and then Matthew tells how it was. And basically, why did you do that, Matthew? And Matthew's only answer is to point to Jesus. And we really mayn't be pointing anywhere else when we confess the certainties and the joy and the freedom of our faith. And that joy and that freedom are gloriously extolled by Lewis. And he himself would not claim to be doing the work of the Holy Spirit creating faith with his thinking it all the way through. But God has given us our noddles to think with, and we should use them as best we can. And when we are using them in a way which blocks out God, it is a great help to have those ways shown to be sort of the silly nonsense or the cowardice to think things through all the way. But what makes us alive is altogether the doing of Christ and his Spirit. And Lewis joyfully acknowledges and accepts that too.